Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bookermy podcast. Every week I ask people at the top of their industry to pick a book from our most wanted lists of new nonfiction so that you literally know what leaders are reading next. This week, our guest industry leader is Roger Parry. He's chairman of a number of public companies, including YouGov PLC. He's the co-founder of the International Marketing Communications Group, MSQ Partners, and of the television drama production company Chrysalis Vision. He's a visiting fellow of Oxford University, and he is himself the author of five books and is non-executive member of the board of taxi firm Uber. Roger Parry.
I want to read Nine Types of Leader, as I think it looks like a fresh and practical take on a subject that needs constant updating. You know, there are lots of academic books about the theory of leadership and quite a few first-person business autobiographies, you know, of the this is how I did it and why I'm so marvellous type. The power of James's book, I think, is that he has a couple of decades of journalistic experience. And he's interviewed and profiled a very large number of different leadership types. Now, some people might think that him coming up with the nine-type taxonomy is a kind of classic journalist gimmick, but personally, I found it a very useful framework because I think there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all approach to the leadership style. I mean, different organizations require different approaches. And individuals change their own style throughout their career.
How have you, Roger, changed your style throughout your career, or has it not changed?
Personally, it's changed a lot, because when I was first a chief executive, that was in the 1990s, the zeitgeist was very much a kind of command and control economy. People actually expected a rather rigid, almost military diktat from the top. Now, I think it is radically different. I think people working in businesses today, particularly professional service firms, are looking for a much more collaborative style of leadership, where they follow the chief executive because they believe the mission.
But oddly, that doesn't play out on the broader political arena, does it? Because we have, well, certainly in recent times, the emergence of the strong man leader.
I think that's right, and it's an interesting paradox. I mean, in my market research, opinion research life at YouGov, one of the things we realised is that the conventional left-right definition of politics has now become very, very blurred. And actually, a more instructive spectrum is authoritarian versus libertarian. And it does seem, in a number of Western countries, that we, the people, are rather attracted by a more authoritarian approach of how to get things done. But I do not believe that is true in the context of organisations, either not-for-profits or for-profit-seeking organisations. I have a strong sense that inside an organisation, people are looking for leadership to be more responsive, democratic and listening.
And do you think, therefore, that organisations, as they get larger and more influential and broader and more global, do you think they should set the standard for leadership as opposed to political leaders?
Well, very interesting question. You can see around us today evidence that organisations are becoming more politically engaged and active and demonstrative. You know, the big oil companies are taking a stance on things. Some of the software companies are taking a stance on things. British supermarkets have taken a stance on taking imports from Brazil, for example. I think that would not have happened 30 years ago. People would have ducked, chief executives would have ducked any form of political engagement, but they now do appear to be comfortable putting their heads above the parapet.
You've hired several chief executives. What type of chief executive would you hire tomorrow?
Horses for courses. It would depend very much on the business or the organisation involved. You know, I hired a chief executive for Shakespeare's Globe Theatre when I was chairman there. That requires a very different approach from hiring a chief executive, say, for Clear Channel, which was an outdoor advertising company with a large blue-collar industrial workforce, you know, putting up billboards and cleaning bus shelters and so on. You do need different people for different roles. Now, organisations have very different requirements. But I do think, almost irrespective of the organisation concerned, I would tend to look for a leader who led through demonstrating vision rather than being attached to the command and control approach.
Hello, Bookermy. I'm James Ashton, author of The Nine Types of Leader, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
You open the book rather like slamming your fist on the boardroom table by saying, in large type, there are only 9 types of leader. Why 9? Why not 10? Why not 7? Why not 3?
Well, I got to 9 and I felt I'd cover the waterfront. And I, if it's helpful, I'll tell you. So there's some types there that you will recognize. There's some that are less familiar. And through my 20 odd years of financial journalism, I started seeing patterns in among the types of leaders that I'd interviewed. And one in particular stuck out to begin with. Why was I interviewing so many CEOs who in their formative years were flogging shampoo and body spray at Procter & Gamble? I sort of launched into that and explored that with some of them. And that became my sellers chapter, the CEOs who had that sales and marketing background. And I thought, well, okay, I know sellers now, and we know founders and scions are those leaders of the family businesses chosen by birth. And I felt this was my corporate happy families, if you like. So I built up and up, and I kept testing the groupings I had with the CEOs I'd interviewed or those that I observed. And I thought 9, that does it. And it's a good number.
It is a good number. And it's not used that often either. So I think it's unique. Well, it stood out to me. You've met and interviewed hundreds of CEOs through the course of your work as city editor at London Evening Standard and the Sunday Times. Some of them I've also interviewed myself. I was wondering if we could swap some notes. You've interviewed Richard Branson, Sheryl Sandberg. I haven't. I have interviewed Peter Thiel and Ed Catmull. Have you interviewed those two?
You've beaten me on that one, Rich. I haven't interviewed those two.
The one that did stick out that I think we both have been in the presence of, but I think you interviewed formally and I was kind of being interviewed by, I was pitching an investment idea to, was Richard Desmond. I don't know what experience you had of him or where you had it. I was at the top of his tower.
Absolutely, yeah. Through glass on 3 sides, overlooking the River Thames. Yeah, it's a wonderful setting for an interview.
We both probably sat in the same seat.
Yeah.
Did he have someone bring a cigar in for him in your meeting?
I think I obviously must have met him later because the butler brought in a banana for this meeting. I think he was trying to smoke a bit less. But it's interesting. I think it's funny. We've talked about the setting without talking about the man. And I tried to put a bit of this in the book, that it's not an academic book. It's very much a journalistic book. So I wanted it to be hopefully a good read. And it's got to have characterization and sights and sounds. And going back to the city interviews, those full pages in the weekend papers that I've done a lot of, so much of it is the person. But I also want to know the where and the how and the when. I think that brings so much, and it actually tells you so much about the person and their willingness. I mean, you would contrast someone like a Desmond. You would always go to Desmond, and he's there and he's eerie over the River Thames. And you think about some of the CEOs who are want to be a little more user friendly. There were many that came to me, so I interviewed quite a few in the coffee shop around the corner from the Evening Standard. And that tells you something about them. It sets up the interview differently. And I think it's, you know, handlers try to make interviews as beige as possible. And I think the authors, writers, and so on have a duty to try and punctuate the beige.
Well, you certainly do that. And I always enjoy nonfiction written by journalists because you make a point of getting into the heart of the human story, and you paint a picture, you set a scene, you know, whether it's the opera or the Chelsea Flower Show, you see leaders in their environment or out of their environments and how they behave. Do all leaders, in your experience, successful leaders, I mean, act a certain way when they meet a journalist? Because I found the most powerful that I meet when I'm talking to them about their book, for instance, I suppose in a journalistic capacity, they have what Viv Groskop calls happy high status. They're very comfortable with their power, where I've met and interviewed people who are uncomfortable with their power and assert themselves in a way which doesn't put you at your ease, for instance. Have you experienced that too?
Yeah, I think being comfortable with their power is a good way of putting it. I think actually those leaders who you might say are not house trained, the ones that are imagine that you should be very grateful because they've found time in their diary and it's the equivalent of you, you know, carrying down tablets of stone with their, you know, with their knowledge on it. I mean, that can still make a great interview. It's very telling. It doesn't do them many favors. So I think most now have realized that there's, or I think the enlightened ones in realize that a good interview is actually a two-way conversation in some respects. I think it's the, you know, the lieutenants, the people moving up through these big corporations learn, I think, is how to be outward facing, how to think about the world around them. What the CEO and the interview setup should realize is that the journalist sat opposite you, they might be 30 years younger, they might be paid a fraction of your salary. They've probably met and talked to more CEOs this week than you have. They've probably got very, very useful insights that you can take from them. It shouldn't be a one-way relationship. And I think good leadership probably is much more of a two-way street now than it used to be with those alpha leaders who were handing down their tablets of stone.
It is interesting how disarming it is when someone you're interviewing asks you a question, whether it's by design or, you know, just for show, but they're showing an interest in you, or they show an interest with the audience that you're with, or they ask something about where you are.
I think it can be unsettling.
Yes.
And that's what it might be designed to do. Yes. But I think I don't even say, Rich, it doesn't really even need to be against the flow. I mean, I think 45 minutes is a great time to do an interview. I'm not one of these journalists that wants to go back three times and interview them at breakfast, lunch and dinner or on their island or whatever else. I think there's a lot you can get in that first take. So they don't need to be asking me something in that session. But I think to show an interest, you know, the before and the after, I think, because, it, you know, leaders need to be media savvy. And I think there's something about having an ongoing relationship. This is not just... we've not just turned up to carry out the trash for you.
And you call them the boss class. How have they changed in the last 10 years? And do they have a look or a general demeanor? How does one know when you've met a member of the boss class, and how do you become a member of it?
Well, how do you become is a long story. And there's an early chapter where I tried to identify, rather than grouping my nine types, I tried to think, well, what have they all got in common? What have they done? And there are certain things you can think of. Actually, one of the things that struck me as interesting is a lot of these leaders didn't try too hard. They didn't stress it to begin with. There are very few that had a piece of paper that they wrote when they were, 13 or 18, which said, I will be CEO by the time I'm 40. They followed their passions, quite a lot of them. I mean, someone like RJ Banger, who is leading MasterCard now, he had no idea. He wanted to join a company that was good and global. I think that was his definition. So he joined Nestle, off he went from there. And I think actually following the passion is something very notable, because talking to some of the recruiters who take people into what you might call the talent factories, the Goldman Sachs, the McKinsey and so on, they are interested in academic excellence, but they're also interested in people with hinterland. That's why you have quite a number of CEOs who have, they're great sports people, jockeys or swimmers or whatever else. They've shown that they can really push themselves in other areas, outside of the classroom. In terms of how they've changed, I think my final type is the human type. So I think there's a few of these types that are in the ascendancy. We would say that alphas are no go anymore. It's a pejorative word. Actually, there are some alphas that are more powerful than ever. Most of them are in Silicon Valley, so they're living on. But I think the types of leader that are really in the ascendancy are perhaps lovers, who I define as these really passionate CEOs. They absolutely love what they're doing. Campaigners, profit with purpose. And I think purpose is already a hackneyed word. Profit with purpose certainly is, but I think coming out of the pandemic, no CEO can be any doubt that the social contract between business and society is stronger than ever. So they need to really think about the wider hinterland. And I think the ninth type, which I think we will see a lot more of, is the human type of leader. So this is on purpose, it's the ninth type. It's at the opposite end of the spectrum to the first type, which is the alpha, the superhuman. So the human is very much, they're very good operating what I call the glass door era. They bring the whole selves to work. They haven't got an image. They're not wearing a titanium suit. They are honest with their people when they make mistakes. And I think they're good at in some areas that previous leaders wouldn't bother with. It would be seen to be unfashionable to listen too much, to focus too much on loyalty. And I think they're very good at that. So I think, and I think, you know, great communicators as well. I think you don't have to, there are examples of CEOs who are, actually there's two things. They probably are great communicators, but they're not particularly media savvy. But on the whole, I think this generation, the next generation, they will be good at communicating with all the stakeholders, internally, externally.
And you say when you get to the top, they must act like the boss, which reminds me a bit of, I think it's Robert Cialdini's book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. I can relate to that. And I don't know if you've ever been in that situation where you get promoted to a top job or a senior job and you try and carry on being yourself when actually it's a new version of yourself that's required. How do leaders in your experience and the ones that you've met deal well and badly with their own ego when, you know, an ego can be a force for good, but have you had experiences or interviewed leaders where it's backfired on them?
Oh yeah. I mean, just on the point about how the, that changing position, you make me think of a point from that RJ Banger said to me, is that as soon as you're the boss, you know that no one ever comes by your office just for a chat anymore. Everybody wants something. And I think the really enlightened leaders are the ones that, you know, you're holding, it's almost like you're like Prometheus, you've got this power and this energy. And it's a question about how you deploy that, how you, how you let other people, you know, what projects you bless, you know, what strategies you back and so on. In terms of ego, it is the thing. It's very, and I've worked with some great journalists who are great at pricking ego. And I think CEOs are getting better at this, but too often they're still surrounded by people who won't tell them how it really is. And I think collectively you can have a lot of people in the same room who have got the blinkers on. We see it coming out of so many companies. You wonder how certain decisions get made and who was in the room when something was said. But I think ego, I'm trying to think of examples. I mean, ego can certainly be the undoing. It's the equivalent of, you know, Kevin Keegan at Newcastle United 20 odd years ago saying, I'd really, really love it. And they do let the mask slip because they get angry. And from a journalist point of view, you know, one little trick, I would always, if I want a CEO to see a story, I'd make sure their name was in it. You've always got to, you know, you always stand a better chance of turning up in someone's personal clippings file if you've name checked them. And then I think it's about the judicious. I always said to reporters in my team, particularly at the Standard, you know, you must get your facts right. If you get the facts right, then you have a license to comment. And I think the license to comment is only a few words. It's a judicious use of adjectives. And I think, It can work in two ways. It can break down walls. It either gets the backup or it gets you the interview. And that interview might be, you know, they might see it as a dressing down. It's still an interview.
You mentioned formative failure as a positive attribute. I once interviewed Lord John Brown, the former CEO of BP. And I asked him if he found failure a useful experience. You know, it was a fairly packed standard question about failure. And I was kind of expecting him to say, yes, I learned from it and I welcome failure. You know, it's the kind of standard issue response of people who say fail forward and learn. And he said, no, failure was just failure and he would never welcome it. And he'd never once think of it as a positive experience. Maybe his views mellowed since, but I found that honesty very engaging, actually.
That's interesting. No, I think I think that's that tells you that John's quite old school. I think I thought he would say, "Well, I you know, when have I failed, Rich?" But interesting. No, I think that's an old view. I suppose, you know, failure is okay if it's in the distant rearview mirror, and I think there is if you're on that leadership path, there's a huge difference between a failure when you're in your 20s, which you can pretty much sweep under the carpet and you know, move straight on, as opposed to a terrible failure when you're leading a listed company and you're in the headlights and your value has been destroyed and people have been hurt. So I think there are different types of failure, but they're all there. I think it comes under the heading of self-awareness that you mustn't just try and push it away. You must try and learn from it. There are good examples in the book. I think the Evelyn Burke, who was running Bupa, is a good example. And David Sproul, who was senior partner at Deloitte, I think he was a very young partner, probably 30. And he was, confessed. It was a really good, honest conversation. I mean, he was terrible to begin with, because I think it's, as you say, he was trying to be an old version of himself, or he hadn't really thought about his new responsibilities and the people around him. And there was an away day, which was pretty catastrophic for him, but he advanced from there anyway.
You're absolutely right about the benefits of failure in hindsight. You never get people patting people mid failure on the back going, thanks for losing the share price. No. Thanks so much. And nobody ever celebrates that. They only celebrate things when they've recovered or they've learned from something and moved on. You mentioned three characteristics in the modern leader: purpose, authenticity, and delivery. Who have you met who has all three in spades?
I think I've talked about this a little bit since the book came out, Rich, and I think delivery is the tricky one, because delivery is in, delivery can be in the eye of the beholder. It can be. I think legacy is an interesting point. You don't really know how well a CEO has done if they're listed until a couple of years down the line. Have the shares held up? Is the strategy recognizable from what they left behind, and so on? I don't want to name check him three times. I think RJ Banger has done very well with MasterCard. I think this point about purpose is, I think it's easier for some companies than others. I mean, he alighted on, there were lots of tech related things he could have done. He alighted on financial inclusion, and there's a lot of self-interest there, because it's about what's good for the world is good for the company. So it's quite hard if you're in something, running something like a tobacco company, to think, what am I doing? What am I doing for the world? But if he observed the global financial system, the global money system, there were, a billion or so people who were not part of that system. If you haven't got an e-wallet or a bank account or something, then you are excluded. And this is where the debate about cashless society comes from today. So I think targeting 500 million and they're now on the way to a billion additions to that financial system was self-interested. None of those are going to make him a profit on day one, by the way. But it was a good thing it was a good addition to the business. No one's asked me who is the total package. That's as far as, in terms of who has delivered as well, who is the perfect CEO? I think the best performing CEO at the moment, and he is, he's one I think about when I think about, usually very, very successful CEOs have to be media savvy, and he won't do a scrap of media. And we've joked about it over many years, but Erik Engström at RELX, the old Reed Elsevier, I mean, it's been an amazing success. And it's interesting because that is almost financial success. He has delivered. Is there a purpose to that company? I'm not sure they're saying they're out there going to save the world. And how authentic is he? Well, I think he is internally, but I christened him the Silent Swede in the Sunday Times about 10 years ago, and he absolutely revels in that nickname. And I must say there are some articles I've written for them that have dug into how they've done a digital transformation. So full package. I'm scratching my head. If it comes up before we finish talking, I'll come back to you with another name, Rich.
Talking of packages, do you think that CEOs are worth it? I mean, are we in the situation where, obviously, it's a market-driven talent business, just like football, and so therefore they get paid what they get paid. But at what point do you start believing your pay packet is commensurate with your ability? Can you pay a CEO too much?
I mean, absolutely. And I think the difficult, because so much of the broader package has to do with how the market is moving, really. I remember doing, there was something about the best value CEOs in the FTSE. I did it many years ago for the Sunday Times, and I think we came up with the leader of Antofagasta, which is the Chilean copper miner. And it just so happened that, yeah, it had been a great year for copper prices. So, you know, how much had he done to become, you know, wonderful value and so on that year? And how much did he just sat there and run a copper business in a good year for copper? I think it is market driven. And I think the challenge is, there are a couple of things. You can't easily clone experience. I mean, there are still only 100 companies in the FTSE, despite, you know, rampant inflation elsewhere. So if you're a headhunter or you're the chair of a company and you're looking for someone that's got, 10 years of relevant experience in an adjacent company or industry, you there's only so many places you can look. And I think because the way risk has gone up the board agenda, what's another 5 billion if you've got absolutely the best person? I think the other element, you talk about football. I think some of these CEOs are being very, very thoughtful about their careers. There's lots of things they can do late 50s and onwards. I think this is more of a European trend than US particular. I think they're giving up the full-time stuff sooner. They might be doing one or two big full-time jobs rather than three they were doing a generation ago. So, yeah, I suppose they want to make out, you know, while they're in the game. And so by stepping away sooner, it does mean that you limit the talent funnel even more.
I think an interesting perspective is also that you raise in the book, and that becomes very clear in the book, is that CEOs are hired on history, on historical performance, much less than, say, a footballer is, or other talent areas, which are hired on potential and on direct performance, or in, you know, week to week. A CEO is hired because a company will, to a large extent, be risk averse and want to make sure that the best person, or the person with the most historical performance or most historically positive performance, is in the job. But that's not the case with founders. And the founder is one of your nine types of leaders. From a journalist's point of view, do you get more excited? Maybe excited is the wrong word. Are you more engaged? And do you have maybe subconsciously more respect for a CEO, a leader who has founded their company, than one who has just, you know, hopped from one big pay package or big salary to another?
I mean, yeah, I think I look for a good story, and quite often that story can manifest itself in many ways. But I think there's something about whether it's the founder or it's the long server who's put their time in. And I think, you know, in this world where leaders are looking for authenticity, one way of getting that is to have served your time. So someone like Steve Rowe at M&S, he's been their man and boy, he's climbed up. He can face the staff in a more honest way than an incomer can, and say, look, you know where we've been, you know what we're trying to do. It's tough out there. I think there are a couple of types, sellers and fixers, who are almost trained to be a bit more short term. I think I call them promiscuous in the book. So and I think there's something about if you've got that great sales and marketing background, and you can you can calibrate the product meets the consumer and the competitive environment, it's really, really you know, compelling to a headhunter, you know. And it's true, I think sellers are good at selling themselves. So who's exciting? I think there must be something exciting about founders. And I don't think it's journalists as much. It's, you know, governments are excited about them because these are creators of business. These are going to, you know, save us from the next recession. I think there is something about the drive and determination of the people who were there, kitchen table, it's a piece of paper, I've mortgaged everything, I've had dark days, and they've gone right through. Because for every founder that's made a success, we know that there are many more that have failed. I think what's interesting, you talked about ego earlier on, Rich. Founders probably need ego as that shell. They hire, successful founders hire well. They also hire people that tell them what they want to hear to some extent. So if I've encountered ego and challenge and people who don't read the brief and say what they want to say, then it's founders. So I'm excited because you get the story, probably rags to riches, and they're also likely to freestyle a bit.
And they're less political, I would imagine.
Political being, some of them are very political, but you mean less diplomatic?
Less diplomatic, less cautious about ruffling feathers or saying the wrong thing, as you say.
No, I think they'll ruffle away. I mean, the great thing, I'll go back to the Richard Desmond example, and people who were setting up interviews, this is for newspapers rather than for books, they are obsessed with pegs. What's the theme? What's the topic? What we're going to talk about? I interviewed Richard, it's quite a while ago now, and there was no agenda. He hadn't done anything for a while. I think we'd come off the back of a downturn for print advertising. And I just got in touch and said, how's the business going? I'd love to do a piece. We came in and chatted. It was off the cuff. It was very colourful. I'd never used the asterisk button so much in an interview. But I hope this is what makes Sunday journalism great, is it was the piece you didn't know you wanted to read when you opened the paper. And so I suppose that's, whenever I've gone into interviewing any of these for the papers, there's always that, the looking for the element of surprise.
And charisma is obviously one of the attributes that you talk about in the book in terms of passion and someone loving what they do. James Daunt, the founder of his eponymous store in London, but also CEO of Waterstones, Europe's largest bookstore, which he was hired to run, as you say, a proud shopkeeper by the Russian billionaire Alexander Mamut, and now also Barnes & Noble working for the investment fund manager Elliott. It feels a bit like there. It feels like his core passion for bookselling, which is obvious, has been exploited at scale for venture capital. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I'm just an observation. Surely that can only go one way. Being cynical, does passion and love and real love ever go anywhere but the wrong way and get broken up where large sums of money are concerned? Because you lose, you lose that independence, you lose that passion and you lose that love. But you can often maybe extrapolate or extract the DNA of passion and the brand of passion and love, say for books, and turn it into something much bigger. But are we just fooling ourselves in thinking that you can be, you can love burgers and run McDonald's, you can love books and run Waterstones?
Well, I think, it's and if you can hear in the background, there's a heavy downpour here now, so it's not me tapping the table heavily. I would say that is one way to look at it. I think if James hadn't gone into Waterstones, it would have become Woolworths. And I think that's so, if passion plus money equals, relatively healthy book chain for the UK, then, I think that's probably all right. I think what that passion gives him is an authenticity with the staff for when he's got to do the difficult stuff. So yeah, but so I think that's okay in that instance. I'm trying to think of some other passion. I think the other places where I've seen where I think passion is very important, and where I think so with the podcast I do, which is called Leading, I interview a range of leaders. There's business ones on there, and actually some of the people I've interviewed fed into the book. There's also arts leaders and charity leaders and so on. And I think there's something quite interesting where passion and purpose is concerned about what profit and non-profit learn from each other. I wrote a piece recently on Doug Gurr's move from Amazon UK to run the Natural History Museum. So he's going from, drone delivery to a centuries old fossil collection. And I don't think a few years ago you'd have seen someone do that mid-career. So I think it's quite interesting. What can corporate leaders borrow from the charity sector? And I think it is that unalloyed passion for the cause, how you get a workforce behind you. Many of them volunteer, by the way. They're not turning up for the money. And yeah, I think there's sort of some interesting overlaps. So passion is not dead yet, Rich.
I should hope not. Where would you place Boris Johnson in your taxonomy of leadership?
Well, I mean, I have jokingly, and I think I say this seriously, I mean, I put him in the lover category. I think there is a great passion for what he does. I think there has been, his critics would say, and I tend to agree with this, I think he has had a great passion for office. And perhaps at times there has been less passion for the nitty gritty, the day by day grind and so on. And it's interesting with, you know, I think leaders are defined by, I think, as I say in the book, they're defined by birth. If they're scions, they inherit the company from their parents or grandparents. They're defined by their training. So that might be the sellers coming up through Procter & Gamble and Unilever, or they're defined by circumstance. So those fixers that have to fix a company. And so, you know, isn't it interesting that he's a great student of the statesman of Churchill in particular. And here is this leader who actually might have a great epitaph because he's leading the country through pandemic, vaccination, and what we're told are going to be the roaring 20s.
Not wanting or expecting you to solve the issue of a fading democratic process, but what type of leader, what kind of leader does the opposition have to produce to counteract rather than mimic the leader of the Conservative Party?
I'm less steady on politics than business. But look, I think when Keir Starmer was appointed, he wasn't a bad shot. He had clearly was a good orator. He was a lot fresher and more palatable than his predecessor. And I think it's interesting. I'm not sure it's the leader that has failed there per se. I think actually what you populate his scripts with and what sits beneath him in the Labour Party is the problem. And I think you've had this rapacious drive by the Tories to, you know, we're not meant to have centre ground anymore, but it's kind of like all ground, whether you call it one nation conservatism or whatever. So perhaps they should have gone with, I forget who ran against him, but some of the, perhaps a woman would be an antidote to Boris. I think actually a woman could combat him quite well. And then I think it's really how maybe you get somebody out of the English region, someone who hasn't come from that Islington background again. Isn't it amazing how it's so much about the person at the top rather than the local candidate these days?
Yes, and as we've just seen in the by-elections, anything can happen, especially up north these days.
Yeah, but I think choice is interesting. And you know, I think in London we've had quite an insipid choice just now. You know, this is meant to be the best city in the world to live and work, and yet there wasn't much of a fight to lead it. And you see the vast array and range of candidates lining up to be mayor of New York. And I wrote a column, I think, a couple of years ago saying, when will London get its Bloomberg? When do we get that? You know, London should be above party politics. And it's obviously counter to party politics at the moment, because Sadiq Khan is a rare Labour politician who is getting elected and winning at the ballot. But I think we should have done better. There's a chapter in the book, one of my types is diplomats. And these are the leaders who tend to be chosen by partnership companies. So I see them in accountancy firms, lawyers, also Arup, the engineer, is in there. And it's funny because some of these firms have been in the past a little embarrassed about this model, about where you ballot the partners, about choosing the next leader, the next senior partner. One of them said to me, this is a little archaic, but we stick with it. I actually think there's a lot to be said for this type of choice. If you look at Linklaters, the Magic Circle law firm, they had a three-way election concluded very recently, three women, and they chose Ada Mar Comiskey out of that, the first female leader of Linklaters. And I think democracy has a lot to recommend it in the right situation, as long as you have done enough to fill that pipeline with talent. And I think the best thing that any outgoing leader can do, the best indicator of their legacy, is that there is a great leader or potential leaders left behind. There's a good bench.
Oh, that's often not the case, though, is it? Because, again, whether it's subconscious or not, leaders tend not to want to be shown up by the skills and the abilities of their successors.
No, you're right. I think a lot of them don't, but I think some of them do, you know, help to bring on. I think sometimes there's those lazy succession hires where they go, okay, we'll give it to the finance director. And that can be, you know, you've got sort of a mini me, not quite as good, trying to forget about the numbers, you know, wearing flasher suits. And, you know, this is a recipe for disaster. But yeah, no, it's interesting where, you know, where democracy plays, and you know, choice is only good as long as you've got something to choose between.
Finally, what's your favorite type of leader to work for, and what type of leader do you imagine yourself to be or aspire to be?
I don't think I'm, you know, breaking new ground if I say that the newspaper industry, you know, over the last few decades has been still fairly unreconstructed. You might recognize, you know, alphas in the office, you know, people who know their mind, and you will know it too. And I think actually some of the best editors I've worked for do have that that gut feeling. So someone like Paul Dacre, you know, he knows his readers, and that there is a relationship that lasted for many, many years. And I have enjoyed working in some of those environments. I think I probably enjoy it now I'm not in those environments. The ones I'm fascinated by and I want to go back and look more closely at are the scions. We've had it underlined again in this pandemic. There, you know, we're living in this era of meritocracy and transparency, but you look around and you think these family-owned, controlled, led companies that go on generation after generation. I've just recorded a podcast with someone at Mars, 110 years old, still owned by the grandchildren. So I'm interested in how those scions decide to carry on the baton, what they do that is absolutely the same as the last generation, and what they do very differently. I mean, there are examples in the book of those that plot the middle line between the past and the future generally do very well. The Bronfman example at Seagram, where you do risk throwing out the baby with the bathwater and so on. And what type am I? Well, I think for the last few months, talking about the nine types of leader, I've definitely been a seller. And if I dare to say I was a diplomat, my wife would laugh me out of the house, as I've said in previous conversations.
James Ashton, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Thanks, Rich. It's great fun.
James's book, The Nine Types of Leader, How the Leaders of Tomorrow Can Learn from the Leaders of Today, is available to buy now in the Bookomi shop. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bookomi.com. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Thank you for listening. And remember, whether you lead a company, a family, or you just want to lead a better life, you'll get smarter, faster together with Bookomi. Bye for now.
Compared to most pods, Rich, there's a bit of production on yours.
There is some, with a small p.
I love Bookomi.